attention is the game with flow. Flow follows focus. Neurobiologically, it does it through driving dopamine and norepinephrine into our system, a bunch of other things. But the point is, without focus in the present moment, you can't get into flow. And the best way to focus on the present moment is when the challenge of the present, the task at hand, slightly exceeds our skill set. So you want to stretch but not snap.
Welcome to Peak 40, the podcast that brings you the tips, tactics, and stories for living your best life in midlife. If you're in your mid-30s to 50s, Peak 40 is the place to get actionable advice on the nuances of nutrition, training, recovery, and mindset in midlife. For the full experience and other valuable resources, register for the Peak 40 weekly newsletter at drbubs.com/peak40 to enhance your lifestyle and start making midlife your best life. Welcome back, or welcome to the Peak 40 podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Mark Bubbs. This is our first episode of season number 3, and I am delighted to be chatting with Stephen Kotler, a New York Times bestselling author and award-winning journalist, as well as the founder and executive director of the Flow Research Collective. Stephen is one of the leading experts on peak performance aging, which he explores in his new book, NAR Country: Growing Old and Staying Rad. In this episode, you'll learn about how wisdom and empathy impact your brain as you age, how to get into flow and add more flow into your life, the difference between deliberate play versus deliberate practice, and how aging can actually be a gateway to exploring new levels of your performance potential. Loads of great insights here from Stephen in this episode, practical insights that you can apply into your daily life. It's been a busy last 12 months for me, a new startup, consulting in pro sport, clinical work and travel, but great to be back delivering a fresh batch of new episodes of the Peak 40 podcast to you. And we've got some great new free Peak 40 resources, free for you and the Peak 40 community, coming down the pipeline in the next few months. So stay tuned for that. All right, let's do this. My conversation with New York Times bestselling author, Stephen Kotler.
Stephen, really appreciate you carving out some time today.
My pleasure to be with you.
Well, listen, I'm looking forward to picking your brain on a number of different topics today. I do have to say your most recent book, NAR Country, is definitely hits close to home, not only for the topic of the book, but the backdrop of skiing and, you know, adventure sports. So could you tell us a little about the impetus for writing this book?
So the book is about peak performance aging, and I work in flow science, right? The study of optimal performance. And it turns out flow science and a number of other areas of interest that I've been working on for 10 to 15 years, but really flow science just kind of goes, like, flows right into peak performance aging. And I'm not the first researcher to sort of follow this path. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, the godfather of flow psychology himself, he wrote a couple core books on flow, and then he wrote like 7 books on adult development, because flow is one of the main drivers of adult development. It's one of the engines that allows us to grow up and really allow us to thrive in the second half of our life. So in a sense, my research was sort of pointing in this way for a long time, and it just came to a head, and sort of it came to this like weird experimental head where, like, in the lab, the old ideas about the traditional ideas of aging, what, like, I like to call the long, slow rot theory, the idea that all of our mental and our physical skills decline over time, and there's nothing we can do to stop the slide. I'm sure you know that was the dominant theory in the 20th century. And then starting in like the late 1990s and moving through now, huge holes have appeared in that theory, like not even small ones, like stuff you can drive a bus through. And by 2019, when I started this book in earnest, on paper, in the lab, now a couple of researchers had taken stuff into the wild, but definitely on paper in the lab, everything we used to think was the user decline over time, can't stop the slide skill, we started to realize they're all user to lose it skills. And we never stop fusing these things. We get to hang on to them, even advance them far later in life than anybody thought possible. It also turns out that there's a whole bunch of cognitive abilities that don't even start coming online until our late 40s and early 50s, stuff we never knew about. And all of it shows on paper that, like, an old dog really should be able to learn new tricks. And I decided to test it. I was 53 at the start of the experiment by taking on, I decided I was going to try to teach myself, as kind of one of the most radical experiments in peak performance aging that I've been able to run, how to park ski. It's the domain in skiing, as you know, involves doing jumps off tricks and on rails and boxes and wall rides. It's very acrobatic. It's very dangerous. And for like a baker's dozen of biological reasons, it's considered impossible or down very, very difficult to learn over like 30, 35. For sure. By the time they get 40, 45, it's impossible. And once you get to 50 or 50, where I started at 53, downright crazy is the only, right, the only response anybody has. And that was where the quest sort of began. And long story very short, we got amazing results. I didn't just learn how to park ski. I learned how to park ski faster than I'd ever learned anything in my life, with a million disadvantages when I started this experiment. And it wasn't just me. It was my ski partner who was applying the same ideas, got just as far. And we went, okay, this is freaking crazy, but we're like a pilot study it too. So
yeah.
We ran the experiment, same protocol, this time with like 20 older adults as age 29 to 70. And it worked extremely well. And that's the story of those experiments and sort of the thinking behind them is what's told in our country, is sort of the big picture. The subset of this, I also wanted to write a book about applied neuroscience. And to do that, you have to actually try to do something really hard and show people what it looks like on a day-to-day basis. So those were the two things that sort of like, I wanted to test all these ideas, and I've been wanting to write a book about the applied neuroscience of performance, which is what I've spent my career studying. And nobody had ever really managed to write an applied book for a bunch of, it's mostly writerly problems. It's not actually like the science has been there for a while, but the writing problems of like trying not to bore the shit out of readers while you're like walk them through a day by day experience so you can understand what's going on is tricky. And, you know,
well, listen, it's tremendous. And, you know, as someone who works in elite sport and pro sport, certainly we see with athletes over the last two decades, just the lengthening of careers, you know, which touches on the themes of your book, but even more so the coaches as well, trying to perform and achieve things in midlife that they have never achieved or hang on to qualities. So if we can circle back, you mentioned, you know, that midlife period, certain cognitive qualities that become more pronounced that we can really kind of lean into. Can you share some of that with us?
Yeah, this is not my research. Got to give credit to a lot of people, but Gene Cohn is the one who really sort of brought it all together. Gene was the original, he's the one who convinced the NIH to create the National Institute of Aging. And
incredible.
He's got a long history here. He figured out, thanks to a bunch of different things. So as we enter our 50s, if we get it right, there's some adult development sort of like things you have to do. This doesn't happen automatically. You have to earn it in a sense. But if you cross through those gateways, there are changes in the brain. Some of them are like genes that just don't activate without a lot of experience. Some is that in our late 40s, early 50s, the two halves of the brain start talking to one another like never before. Generally, they work in opposition. And the divisions are not what most people think. It's the left sees like very particular, the right sees the big picture, that sort of stuff. But they come together in our 50s and start working together like never before. And finally, the brain starts to recruit like underutilized regions, right? By the time you're 50, regions that are going to be used all the time are pretty well mapped out in the brain. The brain goes, oh, you never learned to play a musical instrument. You got like this little portion of your temporal lobe. Let's use it to store X, Y, or Z, or learn X, Y, or Z kind of thing.
Yep.
When this starts happening, the results are whole new levels of intelligence, three kinds of intelligence that are really not accessible before start coming online. Short version is black and white thinking goes away. We start to realize everything's sort of a shade of gray, more relativistically
layered,
right? We get multi-perspectival thinking, so we can see around things, right? And finally, big picture thinking, right? We start to really be able to see the forest through the trees and at whole new levels. This unlocks new levels of creativity, and not just low-level sort of like creativity, divergent thinking, the outside the box, far-flung connections between ideas, the hardest part of creativity to train people in, really critical in our society, really hard to train, start turning online. And then we get whole new levels of empathy and wisdom, both of which are very distinct neurobiological traits we could talk more about, but this is a huge boost and like measurable changes in intelligence, in creativity, and all that stuff. Now, you don't get to hang on to, you have to earn them, and then you have to do stuff to hang on to them.
For sure.
So it's sort of like, it's really, really cool. You get a superpower, but like not for free.
Yeah. It's interesting in the book, you know, you talk about critical thinking and problem solving, creativity, cooperation, communication, collaboration, all these things that are now really highly valued in today's, you know, world. And a big part of that is also probably how the ego also starts to quiet, to your point of being able to kind of see things and the context of things and the wisdom. Maybe can you speak to a little bit of that, wisdom and empathy and the parts of the brain that are getting lit up there?
Yeah. So empathy is a lot of different systems, spindle cells, mirror neurons, there's motor programs, there's a lot going on, but what starts to shift. So the temporal parietal junction, where the temporal lobe and the parietal lobe come together, that is a portion of the brain that does perspective, physical perspective, like am I facing front, am I facing sideways, and mental perspective, right? Is my mind open or closed? In fact, when we have out-of-body experiences, it's this part of the brain that's going haywire, which is to say an out-of-body experience is a radical shift in perspective. That's what's actually going on. Yep. Usually brought on by critical life-threatening situations where your brain goes, oh crap, normal perspective isn't going to save you. But what happens if we shift it radically out here and let you see this sort of top-down view of the simulation kind of thing?
Interesting.
And so this portion of the brain kind of when gets very active and when perspective widens. So like that's what's going on. Wisdom is really cool. And from a peak performance aging perspective, you have to sort of stop and talk a little bit about a different topic before going to wisdom. So wisdom, think of like sort of intelligence or skill acquisition as, you know, facts and techniques. Wisdom is like social intelligence writ large and emotional intelligence writ large. And it's like, it's also the meta rules of how systems may work, right? Not the individual rules, but like the meta rules about systems around systems and things like that. All that stuff is wisdom. Now, it turns out both expertise and wisdom are really important traits from a peak performance aging perspective because they are, big words ahead, danger, neuroprotective against cognitive decline. What that means is if we develop expertise, mastery, and wisdom, we can stave off cognitive decline, Alzheimer's, and dementia. And the reason is this. Alzheimer's, cognitive decline, dementia are predominantly diseases of the prefrontal cortex. Prefrontal cortex is really powerful part of the brain. It's also evolutionarily the newest portion of the brain, and it's the most vulnerable to cognitive decline. We rarely, like the brainstem rarely erodes. You may have a stroke or something down there, but it doesn't sort of erode. The prefrontal cortex will erode over time. And if you want to stop that erosion, you want to birth new neurons and you want really dense neural networks. What forms the densest neural networks across the prefrontal cortex? Expertise and wisdom. And because of a principle in neuroscience known as, another crazy word, degeneracy, which is not anything like what it sounds like. Degeneracy literally means the brain never figures out one way to do something. It'll figure out a dozen. So your brain never really repeats the same pattern with all the exact same neurons twice. It will always recruit new areas and whatever. And in this way, we don't ever just like master a skill one way. We surround the skill from every possible angle. It's this widely redundant network with lots of backed up synapses and neurons and thus impervious to cognitive decline. This was, by the way, funny. So a lot of this work got done in the 80s when they started, and 90s when they were trying to answer a question, which is they discovered that Ronald Reagan had severe Alzheimer's in the second term of his presidency, really severe Alzheimer's. So the question was, okay, how the hell did he govern the country? Like, how do you have to do the toughest job in the world with advanced Alzheimer's? That doesn't make any sense. And they discovered what's known as a cognitive reserve, which is basically wisdom and expertise. In fact, we now know, thanks to Yakov Stern at Columbia, that every quote-unquote leisure activity you learn in the second half of your life, so learning to draw, learning to play a musical instrument, speak a foreign language, read a new book, blah, 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 you gain an additional 8% protection against cognitive decline. It's an 8% increase in what's known as your cognitive reserve. So this, like, we have sort of really great data on like the use it or lose it portion of our mental skills. That's essentially what we're talking about here, right? There's other stuff going on, and we can extend this conversation a million different ways, but that's the broad overview of what we've been talking about.
And when we look at some of the activities that help to prevent cognitive decline, if we go that route and talk about, you know, learning different languages or dancing or even balance work, is that overlaid to this wisdom and mastery? Is that impacting the brain?
Yeah. So if I were to summarize the work in our country in a single sentence, which is kind of funny because I'm basically summarizing 4,000 papers in a single sentence, but here's peak performance aging in a single sentence. Let me define one term ahead of time or two terms ahead of time. So dynamic is a single word that really means any skill that requires strength, stamina, dexterity, agility, and balance. Now, we talked about physical skills declining over time, and they're all use it or lose it skills. I just named the five physical skills that are most important that you have to train. And there's very specific guidelines that the World Health Organization knows. We know exactly how much you have to train each of those categories. It's like 150 to 300 minutes of moderate to vigorous aerobic exercise a week for peak performance aging, right? Two strength training days, three balance agility, and flexibility days, or you find one dynamic activity, say skiing, that hits all those
impacts everything. There you go.
Right. So that's what dynamic means. And the other one I'm going to use is deliberate play. Now, you've probably heard about deliberate practice. This is Anders Ericsson's famous research into the makings of expertise. You need so-called 10,000 hours of deliberate practice. That's repetition with incremental advancement. Mm-hmm. So great idea. But it's, as Anders himself pointed out before he passed, it's only applicable to certain kinds of skills. Very mathematics, learning to play the violin, a couple other. And as a general rule, deliberate play outperforms deliberate practice. Deliberate play is repetition without repetition, or repetition with improvisation. And deliberate practice, I do the same thing all over again, right? And I try to get it a little better. With deliberate play, I don't do the same thing all over again. I do a variation of the thing, but I'm just improvising and playing on top of it. And for a bunch of different neurobiological reasons that we could talk about as we go along, you learn much better with play than with deliberate practice. So the full sentence is this: if you want to rock till you drop, you have to regularly engage in challenging, creative, and social activities that demand dynamic, deliberate play and take place in novel outdoor environments. That's the whole formula. That's the formula. Let me just point out one thing before we dive into it at a high level. Notice what's not in that formula. There's no substances. There's no ice baths or crazy breeding protocols or
recovery tools,
anti-aging supplements, or anything that's owned by anybody that can be sold to you. Like, that's what's not in that sentence. What is in that sentence is 4,000 plus papers and 60 years worth of research from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of scientists at this point. So I'll stop there, let you go wherever you want, but
I mean, it's a tremendous insight there when we even think about sport and how, let's say, it's in some of those real stable environments like golf, when certain golfers are trying to repeat a pattern, that sort of deliberate practice, whereas we see some of the greatest ball strikers were doing more of that deliberate play, like you'd call it, where it's, you know, the Tiger Woods is, where it's one shot low, one shot high, one shot left, one shot right. They're trying to work, you know, out how to control, you know, the golf ball and feel it, rather than simply, you know, mechanically trying to repeat things. So that's, you know, that's really interesting. And if we actually just pivot slightly to the book, when we talk about pushing the boundaries in midlife, but also as a practitioner, we see, you know, if you haven't played a certain sport in a while, or you used to deadlift 500 pounds and now you start to exercise or train, you start to feel good and you ramp back up to that load you once had. Sometimes we see this, you know, exposure to injury and things coming up. But also we do need to balance, like you say, in terms of exposing ourselves to new environments, new challenges. So curious how you navigated that, you know, that.
Yeah, that's
sort
a great question.
In terms of the skiing and whatnot.
This gets into what did we do in our actual protocol? Like, how the hell did I learn to park ski and that sort of stuff? Let me start with flow. And let me, so flow is optimal performance. And one of the things optimizes is learning and memory. And studies run by the Department of Defense, soldiers in flow will learn 240 to 500% faster than normal. So huge, huge boost in learning and memory in flow. Erickson and I used to talk about this, that flow mounts a very good challenge to 10,000 hours to mastery, because flow seems to massively accelerate that path. So, but flow states have triggers. So you want more flow in your life, right? You want the performance benefits of the state. These triggers are your toolkit. The most important is probably very familiar to you. It's known as the challenge skills balance. We pay the most attention to the task at hand when the challenge of our task slightly exceeds our skill set. And attention is the game with flow. Flow follows focus, shows up when all of our attention is the right here, right now. Neurobiologically, it does it through driving dopamine and norepinephrine into our system, a bunch of other things. But the point is, without focus in the present moment, you can't get into flow. And the best way to focus on the present moment is when the challenge of the present, the task at hand, slightly exceeds our skill set. So you want to stretch but not snap. This is the Erks Dobson curve.
It's a good line. Stretch but not snap.
Applies physically. Years ago, Csikszentmihalyi put a number on this. He sat down with a Google mathematician and said, can we put a number on this for the average person, the average situation? And they came up with 4%. Meaning we pay the most attention to the task at hand when the challenge is about 4% greater than our skills. Now, that was a metaphor. It wasn't science. It was a metaphor. They did a back-of-the-envelope calculation.
Yeah.
We took the calculation at the Flow Research Collective. We hammered on it for about 6 years trying to test it. I never felt like – so I still don't think this is science, but it's one of the most damn accurate metaphors to steer by I've ever encountered.
Right?
I can't tell you
by.
It's science. I really can't. But it's really a useful metaphor. But the point is – 4% is interesting because, like, for those who are mellow or shy or meeker, a little more timid or risk averse, it's right outside your comfort zone. So you got to get comfortable being uncomfortable. For hard charging type A types, the problem with 4% is it's too freaking small, right? Hard chargers will take on something that's 10, 20, 30% greater. And we know those big challenges are great for motivation. But what the flow science tells us is you want to chop it down so the challenge in front of you is really about 4%. That said, all this started with a very simple insight, which was thanks to allostatic load, the accumulation of stress over time and its impact on the nervous system and our reaction times and processing speeds and things like that, we thought the challenge skills sweet spot had shrunk down to like 1% in older adults.
Wow.
And so one of the things that was happening, you just described a scenario where like older adult comes back to their thing they used to do.
Feeling good for a week or two. Let's do a 1RM.
One of the reasons is they're going too fast. And they're going too fast because they don't know, they're using their old challenge skill sweet spot. They don't realize it's massively shrunk. Mm-hmm. And that, so we started with a very simple premise: go slow to go fast. Start with a hardwire motor pattern that you can do 100% of the time with no conscious interference and no fear, and build on it one tiny motion at a time. Now, that's part A. Part B was, remember, it was park skiing. So our goal was not to teach people how to park ski. That was the byproduct of being in the terrain park. Yeah. Our goal was to teach them 8 foundational movements, 8 new ways to move their body: a crouch, a slash, a grind, a 180, a 360, even done on sliding on the surface of the snow, not even done in the air, a jump, and a couple other things I'm forgetting right now. But these are all the 8 basic motions in park skiing. And all we wanted to do was teach them to creatively interpret that big snow mound over there. It might be a jump. It might look like a jump. Great. Somebody might want to use it to jump. We just want you to use it creatively. Creativity is another flow trigger. So when we link ideas together in a novel way, that's pattern recognition, it produces dopamine. If you've ever done a crossword puzzle, get an answer right, little rush of pleasure, that's dopamine, right? So that also shows up when we identify what physiologists and vision specialists talk about as affordances. When you look at a mound of snow and go, oh, wow, that's perfect to throw a snow grind across, you're mapping, that's pattern recognition. You're recognizing an affordance, an opportunity for action provided by the environment. Mm-hmm. And that also produces dopamine. So we knew if we could get people creatively interpreting the terrain park, dopamine plus dopamine plus dopamine plus the novelty. Novelty also creates dopamine, is another flow trigger. We would start to drop people into flow, learning would spike, and everything else would take care of itself. Why? The last bit of what we were doing is we were playing by some very hardcore flow rules to amplify learning and memory. One was we played follow the leader. So we would get in a long line based on like skill, ability, and really speed preference. Yep. And the goal was there was no talking. There was no explanation. No, this is how the trick works. It was all embodied cognition. Watch what the person in front of you is doing.
Incredible. And,
so one of the things you may know this as a coach, but so we have mirror neurons. When we watch another person perform an action, our brain performs the same action. Everybody knows mm-hmm. this who studies mirror neurons. What most people don't know is you get a signal, go or no go. If you have the motion, you'll get a little squirt of dopamine. If you don't, you'll get a little squirt of norepinephrine, which feels like fear and anxiety. And yeah. we get a signal. Our brain gives us a signal whether or not you have the move or not. So wow. literally, we tell people to play follow the leader. If you have the move, try to do what they did. If you don't have the move, dial it way back. 1 inch at a time is the motto, right? Only do something just slightly outside 1%, right? So that's sort of how we did it. We actually had to hold people back. In fact, funny story. First day of the experiment, morning of the experiment, I turned to the other scientists who were running it with me. And I'm like, guys, there's no way this is going to work. There's no way. I mean, like I was at the preliminary meeting. These people are terrified. Some of them are intermediate skiers or park skiers. They're scared to death. Like, great. We got a good data. But I was like, don't get your hopes up. There's no way it's going to work. Right. Let's just try to keep people out of the hospital.
Fair enough.
By the end of the day, I was like, holy shit. Oh, crap. We got to hold these people back. Because if we don't, they're going to all put themselves in the hospital. We couldn't believe how much. It wasn't just it worked. A little bit, it worked. It's freaky what happens. And we have a bunch of other rules that sort of were meant to ensure people stayed in flow. They're pretty simple rules, basically meant to keep the ego shut down and shame and embarrassment turned off, right? Like stuff like that. But besides, that's all we did. It was a very simple protocol. It was actually like the funny thing is there's a ton of science in it, but it's mostly about what we didn't do, right? It's not what we did. We did very little. Right. But we didn't do a ton of stuff that people have been trying to do in these kinds of high risk environments for a really long time when we just totally inverted the normal learning processes.
Hey, friends, quick note to let you know the fall 2023 Peak 40 coaching program is open for enrollment. If you're ready to make a change this fall, better energy, better mood, better sleep, losing weight, here is a little inspiration from 54-year-old architect Lyle.
I was telling a friend, I just started trying to do something to do with my mood and sleep habits. And as a benefit, I've lost weight, so, which is a good thing. Everybody's saying like, man, you're so trim, you know? So, and the other thing that was a huge, and I'm monitoring it still, is my cholesterol level. You remember I sent all of my markers were back to normal quite quickly, but it was really amazing. I'm probably now at 195. I'm down probably 40 pounds compared to 3 years ago, which I didn't realize.
As you can see, small changes, the right small changes, done consistently over time can yield some impressive results. If you're ready for change, join us this fall for the 2023 Peak 40 coaching program. That's nutrition, training, and lifestyle support. Just head over to drbubs.com/peak40 or email Carly at drbubs.com, Carly at drbubs.com for more details. All right, let's get back to the conversation.
That's tremendous. It's amazing when you have, with kids and stuff, just watching. I've got three kids. You watch the youngest kid watching the middle kid and the oldest kid, and how fast the youngest kid learns compared to your first child who didn't have anybody to look at. And all of a sudden the youngest is learning how to use the scooter or skateboard 3 years ahead of one that came first.
It's amazing, right?
And you think that we lose a little bit of that, but it sounds like if we put ourselves in the right environment, we could still explore that.
Yeah. Two things that are worth pointing out. This goes back to, play, dynamic play and or dynamic motion and play. So two things that are worth knowing. This is really cool. One, dynamic motion isn't just great for your body. It's the only kind of physical activity that does this, but it amplifies neurogenesis, the birth of new neurons. So when your brain has to coordinate like balance and strength and agility and all that stuff together, you actually get new neurons. Nothing else does this in exercise, but when they talk about exercise being neuroprotective, this is why. But it's not all exercises created equal. You can run on a treadmill. It's going to be good for your heart. It's not good for your brain. It's not doing anything for your brain. But so we're getting new neurogenesis. Even better, we've all heard about the motor learning window that slams shut when you're 25, right? Don't become a ballerina after 18. Don't learn gymnastics. Right. So it turns out, like everything else we've been told, partially true, there's a motor learning window and it does close in and around when the prefrontal cortex reaches maturity. And there is stuff with language and certain facilities that do appear. They're gone. I don't think they're gone forever, because I think we just haven't figured out how to turn a couple of these things back on. But as a general, that window turns out to be much more plastic than we ever imagined. Mm-hmm. And what actually changes is not our ability to learn. It's how we learn. Kids learn through play. Adults get fucking serious. And when you get freaking serious, shame goes up, embarrassment goes up, self-consciousness goes up, conscious processing of information goes up. And as you know, like all good motor learning, these are unconscious things. We can't, you can't think fast enough to surf a wave. It has to be unconscious, right? So what changes is not the motor learning window. It's how we learn is what radically shifts. And if we go back to a very playful style of learning, especially with dynamic motion, because it's birthing new neurons, the combination provided we get a good night's sleep afterwards means we get to learn difficult, if not impossible, skills later in life, which is really freaking cool.
Yeah, it's amazing what the body and brain can do. And like you say, what we've the limits we thought we had, that we can actually continue to push and continue to, as we're seeing performances extended now well into the 40s, into the 50s, into the 60s.
Well, where a lot of the, so you know the story about VO2 max.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, right, VO2 max was like, this was the thing. It didn't matter what you said about peak performance aging. Somebody would beat you over the head with VO2 max. It starts declining in our 20s. It falls off a cliff at 50 and shut the blank up, right? Like that was every physiologist you talked to forever. And then that weird thing started happening in ultra marathoning. They started to notice the 60 and 70-year-olds were beating the 40 and 50-year-olds consistently. And somebody was like, well, how the hell is that happening? And they went and they measured the VO2 max of octogenarian triathletes and ultra runners. And they found that it's the VO2 max of healthy 25 and 35-year-olds. Like that's what, right? So the world record is a dude who's 81. He's got the VO2 max of a 25-year-old. That's the best they've found so far.
Yeah.
But this, and the secret, it wasn't like they were dealing with supermen and superwomen. It was people who started training regularly in their 50s. It was the three decades of upper respiratory training that does this.
A massive, massive base building when you're coming over a decade, years. Tremendous. Well, listen, could we pivot and circle back to the question about ego, shame? Because I think this is a huge aspect, even working with, whether it's athletes or coaches or high performers, executives, taking on new challenges is daunting. And putting yourself out there again, whether it's post-injury or post some kind of setback, can also be daunting for a lot of individuals. And it does get back to those elements of ego and shame and these types of things. So can you touch on that and maybe some of the strategies or tools that you've used to help quiet that, as you say?
Yeah, for sure. One, and I think this is the most important, figure out who you are and how you like to learn and don't deviate. Let me give you an example. Your personality has a huge impact on how you like to learn. And it changes slowly. I mean, yes, these are not hardwired traits at childbirth. We have more flexibility and personality than we thought. But you go try changing risk aversion quickly, right? Mm-hmm. Or introversion levels quickly. Like, they don't change quickly. They take like a decade to move. And they, I'm an introvert, really serious introvert. And I don't mind being bad at stuff. I can laugh at myself. I can fall down and get back up, but I hate being bad in public. I don't like embarrassment. I don't like shame. So this was one of the challenges, by the way, for learning to park ski. Terrain parks get built under chairlifts. It's yes. the worst possible place for me the to audience. Learn. What we started to do, me and my ski partner, is we would go into the wild, build natural terrain parks at the edge of ski resorts where nobody could see us, in the woods, basically, and learn there. So first, figure out how you like to learn and don't deviate. You're not going to learn in other environments. And this means, let me give you an example just out of my own life in skiing. I have lots of friends who are not shy. You know what I mean? And don't mm-hmm. mind the spotlight and don't mind being under the chairlift and that sort of stuff. And I wouldn't ski with them. Like, I just stopped skiing with them. I was like, no, I'm on a quest. I'm here to learn something. I'm working. And I can't, like, as fun as it is to hang out with my friends, this is not what I'm doing today. And I can't do it your way. I'm not going to learn well in a big crowd. So, like, I'm sorry I can't ski with you kind of thing, or be with mm-hmm. you and hang out. I'm by myself. And a lot of times it means that I'm leaving groups of people. Like, went out where the group of people went, okay, this is not working for me, so I'm going off to be by myself, because that's the prime conditions for learning. Another example is I warm up very slowly. I have a very particular 4 to 5 run warm up. This is not all that common in pro skiing. Pro skiers, like, they get to the mountain and they want to charge really fast right out of the gate. They like to clear the cobwebs out.
Yep.
And I ski with a lot of these people, and it's great because you get so much better, but I can't start the day skiing with them, because what ends up happening is I never warm up properly and I'm always behind the eight ball. I'm likely to get hurt, right? All that. So, like, some of it is about figuring out, a lot of it is, what is exactly perfect for you as a person, as an athlete, and then don't deviate despite all the other stuff that comes with it. Because there's a lot that comes with it, even with something just as simple as I'm trying to go out and do this recreational activity with my friends. No, there's weight and social objectives. There's a bunch of stuff. Mm-hmm. And you have to barricade yourself off against that stuff first and foremost. The other thing that was important to me was my goal was one inch at a time. Self-expectation ruins more days, business, athletic, marriage, other like self-expectation is the crusher of days, as far as
true,
right? Not, which is not to say I don't track progress, but I track progress. My goal was learn these 20 tricks, get from zero to intermediate in as fast as possible. That was the goal. Right. And these 20 tricks are represented, as I said, the path from zero to intermediate park skiing. And everything else sort of, you know, like, it didn't matter. That was the focus. And but some days it was like maybe I'd go off and ski a big line, but I just, like, the terrain park wasn't in me. And if you try to force it on an individual day by day basis, you go to the hospital. That's how you get hurt. Right.
Yeah.
So my goal was, I want to go to the ski hill. I want to advance the cause by one inch, right? I just have to learn one tiny thing. And if I'm not feeling the terrain park, I also, there was 20 big lines I wanted to ski over the course of the season, because I didn't want my big mountain ski prowess to taper off. I've been working on that for my whole life. So I didn't want to lose those skills while learning a new skill. So sometimes I'm like, oh, okay, I'm not feeling the terrain park. Let's go into the mountains, vice versa. That's the challenge skills balance. Also, this is when the challenge level got too high in the terrain park, meaning I was scared, right? Yeah. I wasn't just focusing my attention. Fear crushes performance, and it's how you end up in the hospital, right? So another rule is, the minute I feel fear, back off and come back later. This is not like, don't try to be a hero, because you can't make progress from hospital bed. This I know, right? Like, you just can't do it. Don't do it. Live to fight another day, 1 inch at a time, all that stuff. And for me, and I think for most people who are serious about their craft, that's the big thing, is going slow, is holding yourself back and getting rid of the self-expectation and giving yourself sort of more flexible and different measuring sticks. Mm-hmm. Right. My measuring sticks for the season were literally, it was lap count.
Okay.
I set a lap count for my days, right? Totally untied to anything else. Cause I knew like this many laps is just a low energy day. This many laps is a standard workout. This is a great workout. I sort of knew that if it was a great workout, I probably meant I got into the terrain park and did some stuff or skied some big lines or whatever. Mm-hmm. Right. But that wasn't how I was going to measure progress. That was just what the goals were for the season. The day was a metric that was unattached to outcome, but close enough related that one might produce the other. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, 100%. And it, you know, transfers so well to when someone's making lifestyle changes or nutritional changes or training changes, like you say, of being flexible of, hey, today I'm not feeling that strong or I'm tighter in the gym. I'm going to adjust. I'm going to pivot because I'll keep moving towards the mountain, as you say, and gain that inch, but I don't need to then do something, you know, stupid that's going to then sacrifice. Oh, now I'm injured. I've got to regress for the next 2 months. And similarly with, you know, whether it's weight loss or improving blood pressure, blood sugars, people sometimes get stuck into every day having to be right on the point, right on the plan.
Slow to go fast.
Yeah.
And it's also, I mean, the other thing, because you were asking about shame questions. This is the other one. I think it's a big one, is you're going to fuck up. Mm-hmm. Like there are going to be days where it literally does not work and you backslide. And if you, the standard, like couple days in a row of backsliding and people give up on the goal, right? They don't realize that like, no, this is a like 5-year goal. It's a 10-year goal. Of course, there's going to be days where I backslide. That's not reason to quit. It's not even like double. I don't have to double down. I have to. No. Oh, okay. I messed up for
just
a couple
part
days.
Of the process.
Just go back to what I'm doing. Right. It's again, go slow to go fast. This is just a foundational rule in peak performance in general. And a hard one.
Yeah. I was going to say, how do you help people with that, Stephen? Because as we go, you know, as you write in the book, it's great that we're living a lot older than we ever have. So we're going to be older for longer. And if we want to perform 50s, 60s, 70s, we do need to build sort of these systems that we can better stay into these processes of slow before fast. So what kind of, you've obviously alluded to it here and talk about it in the book, but what are, again, some ways to help keep people on that sort of path so they don't diverge into trying to get all that progress in a short block of a month or whatever it might be?
That's a great question. It's one of the reasons I wrote the book. I said I wanted to write, one of the reasons I wrote the book is I wanted people to see what applied peak performance works like. And this is, you know, another thing I'm sure you tell people this too, is, you know, this peak performance, it always works like compound interest, right? Yeah. It's a little bit, then it really starts to get exponential, but not for a while. You have to sort of celebrate the win, like, oh, I made some progress, and then completely let go of your addiction to progress. Cause it, and you know, and this isn't, I'm not just speaking as a, like an athlete here. I'm like, this is true. This is so true in business too. Mm-hmm. This is so true in writing when I write books, right? You can't like show up expecting just cause yesterday was this amazing day that you're the same writer today. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, if yesterday I led a great meeting for my company, it doesn't mean, right, I'm going to do it today. Like, that's one of the things that, like, sort of every time you roll the dice, it's fresh. And, mm-hmm. and it's sort of, it's worth, there is consistency over time and there is mastery. There's stuff you get better at. But, like, the day-to-day variations are really, really great. And you can't, like, you have to be proud of the fact that you showed up. If you happen to make some progress, I think you want to notice it because you want the dopamine that for the win, because it's motivation and momentum, but you don't want to linger there because it's addictive and it's sticky and it's really easy for my brain to go, oh, today you learned a 180. Tomorrow you'll get the 180 with the safety grab, and it'll be, and it just doesn't work. Sometimes it works like that, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it'll be 3 months before I can do that. And yeah. I'm interested in showing up and trying hardest and not like, there are good days, there are bad days. It's not, I don't judge them anymore. Because oftentimes the bad days turn out to be the good days in hindsight and vice versa. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, they fuel the good days, don't
never
they?
Never what so you think it is either.
100%. And what's next for you then, Stephen, in terms of pushing these boundaries, you know, peak performance as you 50s, 60s, you know, what are some other challenges that you're at?
It's interesting. It was me, Hatchikson, and I was the last conversation we passed away. He was the one who sort of, you asked what happened. The main thing that kicked me into gear is that I had a conversation with Mike. It was our last before he died. And he basically said, look, man, get a backup plan as you age. Don't just do one thing for flow, skiing in my case, right? That sort of was my bet. He's like, because he used to be a rock climber and a mountaineer, and that was his main source of flow. And he got to a point in his life where he couldn't do those things anymore. And it really, like, we know flow boosts the immune system. It lowers the stress response. It underpins a lot of elements of peak performance aging that are just critical. And our appetite for flow doesn't diminish. We know this. Somebody has last study actually showed it, that we stay as hungry for flow, and it is as tied to happiness and well-being and meaning and purpose until the very end.
Incredible.
So he said, you know, find lots of ways to get into flow. So park skiing was my first adventure. I've been teaching myself how to draw. You asked what's next, what's going on. I've been drawing, which I'm getting better at, but like, you know, I haven't drawn in 25 years and I'm rebooting an old skill, but I'm starting to believe more work to be done, but we have four lobes of the brain. And anytime we learn a skill, right, we develop these diverse networks in those lobes of memories, and it's neuroprotective. So I'm starting to think we may need one activity per lobe to really protect the brain against cognitive decline. This is, at this point, not wild speculation, but semi-wild speculation, right? But there's data there. We've been talking about it a lot at the Inside the Flow Research Collective with a bunch of neuroscientists, and we've been looking at it. We don't know if it's real, but I'm starting to think that way. It's certainly not a bad approach. I don't think it's going to do any damage. There's that. We're working on tons of research. We're always doing tons of research at the collective. We've been working a lot on the neurobiology of intuition. Intuition gets very clear and loud in flow. And the question is why? What's going on in flow that makes intuition seem to work better? It's not isolated. Meditation does this as well, mindfulness. And there's some data on what happens in mindfulness. We don't know if the same thing is happening in flow. And it certainly seems like louder and clearer in flow. A lot of people, myself included. So we've been doing a lot. I'm doing a book for research on intuition, and I'm working on a book on intuition. I'm also working on another novel and probably like 17 other things, but we'll stop there.
Yeah, tremendous. Well, listen, I mean, the book is really inspirational, and obviously, you know, the deep science as well. So appreciate you carving out some time today, Stephen. Where's the best place for people to stay connected and up to speed with all your work and writing?
So narcountry.com, narcountry.com is the website for the book. In fact, just funny for laughs, really. When we ran our peak performance aging experiment, we had a National Geographic camera band follow the group around, right? This was we were measuring progress. We used the Olympics judges park skiing using a very specific criteria. So we videotaped them on their first days and their last days, and then we got an independent panel of judges to rate their progress. They improved, by the way, their park skiing skills improved in 4 days of training by 26.5%, which is pretty incredible based on this. But anyways, we turned it into some really funny videos, which are on the website, which anybody can watch. So you can go there and see the progress. StephenKotler.com gets you to me. FlowResearchCollective.com gets you the company, if you're interested in learning more about what we do and training with us or anything like that, @ Stephen Kotler on social. And I think the marketing is now behind us.
Tremendous. Well, again, really, really enjoyed the book. All your work has been definitely impactful for myself, and I know a lot of the listeners. So appreciate you coming out the time.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Well, listen, if you have any questions, love to hear from you. Reach out on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at Dr. Bubs. Use the hashtag Peak40 so we can find those questions easily and use them on a future episode. And if you found this useful, please share with friends, colleagues, or anyone looking for Peak 40 health and performance.
The Dr. Bubs Performance Podcast endeavors to provide accurate and helpful information to listeners. These podcasts cannot take into account individual circumstances and are not intended to be a substitute for health and medical advice from a qualified health professional. You should always seek the advice of a qualified health professional before acting on any of the information provided by any of the Dr. Bubs Performance Podcasts.